Sam Taylor at Barbecues in Patchogue. That's a 7:30 start, and when Sam takes a break, you can bounce across the street to the Brickhouse Brewery and catch Kane Daly, who will be performing over there. And here's the quote of the day by P.J. O'Rourke. Giving money and power to a government is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys. If you want to see more shows, go to WUSB.FM and click on Concert Billboard. Thank you for listening to the Concert Billboard and to WUSB.
Where the time is 2 minutes after 6 o'clock, time once again for Off the Wall. Good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. It being Tuesday, of course, that means there's yet another round of political nonsense going on out there. Today, it's the states of Kentucky and Oregon. Yes, what a match that is. Oregon, yes, out there on the West Coast, and Kentucky out there somewhere in the Middle East, Midwest. And, yeah, it should be interesting. Hillary Clinton is going to win Kentucky, and Barack Obama is going to win Oregon. Now, Clinton's supposedly going to win Kentucky by a much wider margin than Obama will win Oregon. So, read into that what you will. You have to wonder, though. You look at recent returns because of the various states that have had primaries recently. States like Pennsylvania, states like West Virginia, now Kentucky, and various places like that. Before that, we had Ohio, all Clinton states, but all fairly late in the game. Now, what you have to wonder, this is the question no one really seems to be asking, but basically, it sort of is part of the whole theory that momentum is gained based on how certain contests wind up. And this is why you have people dropping out after Iowa, after New Hampshire, very early in the game, before anybody really has a chance to say anything, because they've lost that momentum. They feel that if you don't perform well in particular states, you're not going to perform well in other states because of what happened in those states. So it's not like you're even giving people a chance. Now imagine if Pennsylvania, if West Virginia, if Ohio, if Kentucky, if those states had all been featured pretty early on in the contest. And the states that went to Obama, if those states hadn't shown up until later in the game, might we be looking at a Clinton nomination right now? Because that's how the system works. It's all based on momentum. And how that momentum is defined, how it gets created in the first place, it just seems kind of arbitrary almost. So yeah, it could have been a very different race if it had played out in a different order. And who determines the order? Why does Iowa get to go first? Why does New Hampshire get to go first? Look what happens when some states decide they want to move up a little bit, like Michigan and Florida. They have to pay a very severe penalty for that. like not being counted at all. And that's going to be resolved supposedly at the end of this month. I don't know how. I'm not sure how they're going to do it. But one way or another, I think the way to have done it, and not that I would have liked this, but the way to have done it would be for half of the money to come from Clinton's campaign and half to come from Obama's campaign, and then they could have just said, "Look, we're paying for a new election. Aren't we nice? Vote for us." Or one side could have paid for the whole thing, and then, wow, look how nice we are, and look what jerks the other guys are. Or McCain could have paid for it too, and I don't know how people would have interpreted that. So yeah, weird stuff out there. I was driving out to Dayton, Ohio for the Dayton Hamvention last weekend. Once a year, a bunch of us do this. Start up the 2600 van, the old 1981 Dodge Ram Telephone Company van. I don't know how many of you have actually seen it, but it's a sight for sore eyes. And every year it's more of a sight for sore wallets, as it cost a fortune to get out there. I mean, I think it was about $200 in gas just to get there and $200 in gas to get back. So, yeah, I know of what I speak when I talk about all the crazy people out there driving huge vehicles that they don't need to drive. And how much gas can cost. But in this particular case, once a year, we need a van to go to this event because we're carrying all kinds of back issues and t-shirts and sweatshirts and coffee mugs and whatever else that we're going to be selling at the Dayton Hamvention, which is basically a gathering of tens of thousands of ham radio operators and enthusiasts. And the two worlds kind of merge in various ways. There are parallels between people who like to play with radios and people who like to play with computers and telephones and various other bits of technology. This has existed for a long, long time. We're all hackers of a sense. Some of us believe the other ones are immoral. Some of us believe the other ones are boring. There's all kinds of chasms and gulfs and things like that that need to be bridged. And that's one of the reasons why we go to Dayton, is to bridge those gaps and get into all kinds of conversations with people walking by. Basically, it's all taking place in a parking lot, and we pull our van up, take up two spaces, and all kinds of other people are around us selling old bits of hardware and everything from compact discs to wire cutters to actual pieces of wire and string, and you name it, somebody is out there with some bit of technology or something that might be exactly what you're looking for, or at the very least, something that you never thought of before. And so we spend usually about 3 days there, the whole weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, just standing around in front of the van, a bunch of us, talking to whoever comes by, hopefully selling them something, but if not, having a good conversation. And you always meet interesting people in these places. You always do. That's something about the Midwest I like. You always have very interesting conversations with people, very philosophical and filled with all kinds of allusions and references. And that's something, unfortunately, a lot of people around here don't seem to get. They don't seem to get that there's a lot of value in different parts of the country, different ways of doing things, different people, different backgrounds, different customs. It's all fascinating. And just riding out there on the highway, you're with a whole different group of people. You're with all the truckers going by, speeding by at huge velocity, and you're stopping at these rest areas where I heard one guy... They're very friendly, first of all. Everyone's always extremely friendly. But at one rest stop, one of the guys behind the cashier was telling a customer that if you want to get close to perfect, you got to get close to Pittsburgh. I'm not kidding. He said this and he meant it. If you want to get closer to perfect, you have to get closer to Pittsburgh. And, you know, I kept a straight face through that. And the person that he told it to said, "Well, I'm from Pittsburgh. Thank you very much." Pittsburgh, this is the height. The height of everything. This is as good as it gets. I didn't want to start about New York and what that was like, but, you know, it's different. It's different upbringings, different set of values. You just have to sort of respect other people's values. And if somebody says that they think Pittsburgh is the best place on earth, well, then, you know, you just sort of have to accept that people can be very, very different. Extremely so. But I always miss New York. As soon as I hit New Jersey, that's when I start feeling homesick for New York, because I see it there in the rearview mirror, which, by the way, fell off. That's another story. On the way back, we discovered that the rearview mirror for the van, and this is what happens when you have an old van, just decided it wasn't going to stick to the window anymore and fell down. And so we had to go to an auto parts store and mix all kinds of solvents and activators together and have a whole big, like, chemistry experiment to get the mirror to stick back onto the front window so I could see what was behind me. And look back at Dayton as I was heading back towards New York. It's always fun. We stopped in this other place called Yellow Springs, Ohio. You ever hear of Yellow Springs? Now, apparently there's a college there named Antioch College, which is closing down. And this town, Yellow Springs, is kind of like the Austin of Ohio. It's sort of like, an oasis from all that is around. It's sort of a beatnik gathering. All these people with long hair walking around and all sorts of alternative stores and vegetarians and books and things like that. You know, you don't normally see in other places. Not a whole lot in the way of chains. And the fear is that without the college there, this whole place might simply cease to exist. And that would sure be sad. And I'd never seen that place before. It's not very far from Dayton. It's only maybe about half an hour away, 20 minutes away. It's worth checking out. It's the town is really not that big to start with, but it just feels different. It feels like you're not in Ohio anymore. And that's kind of cool when you're in a weird place to go to an even weirder place within that place and feel like you're in a place that's a little bit more similar to home. Very strange. But that's what it's all about, is to walk around the strange place. And, of course, Dayton has what's known as the Oregon District. It's got nothing to do with the state of Oregon, which we're going to get into more later. But this is kind of the cool area of town where you walk around, and there's literally people playing music on the streets. People just take guitars and sometimes drums and just stand in front of a store and play songs. And apparently that's okay. You can't do that here. You can't do that here. You can't just start playing music. Got to have permits. Got to have permission. But there, for some reason, it's not a problem. It's not a problem at all. So, yeah, sometimes you run into customs that are actually more in your direction and go beyond where you think you are. And maybe that's got something to do with being in a state like Ohio to start with, where it's generally more conservative and less in the way of weirdness going on, like New York-style weirdness. So when people express themselves, they express themselves a lot. And that's a cool thing. So the Oregon District of Dayton, yeah, you know, you see some real individuals there. We also stopped in Wheeling, West Virginia, which has become another custom. All these customs now, you know, we always head out in the van, drive all night long. I get into this mode where I just get behind the wheel of this vehicle, this very, very loud vehicle. You're inside it, and you can barely have a conversation with whoever is with you. And if you're lucky enough, you can figure out a way to play music in a device there. There's no radio in that thing, but you have to kind of rig it up so that you can play a boombox or something with a cassette adapter and hook an MP3 player into that. And if you do it right, you can actually hear the music over the engine, because the engine is right there with you. If you look at a van, the engine is literally between the passenger and the driver underneath the covering. And so It's just this very loud noise. You have to put up with it. The drive is about 12 hours, but in the van it can take longer because, we have trouble getting up hills. It's a standard shift, so it's a lot of work. But I get into this mode where I just once a year drive all night. We start after the show in the city, after Off the Hook, well, after we go out and, you know, have dinner, and after we go out and have coffee or tea or whatnot, as I choke to death. And then it's after midnight, and we decide to start then, and we usually arrive sometime in the afternoon in Dayton. And that's after making a bunch of stops, doing various things, looking at the strange sights. And Wheeling, West Virginia is one of those sites. We just kind of hang out in that city and walk around and kind of rest and just kind of see another place. This time I saw the island, Wheeling Island, which is actually midway between Wheeling, West Virginia, and the state of Ohio. And you go over this really crazy-looking bridge to get there. It doesn't look like it can possibly hold you, but you go over it, And all of a sudden, you're on this island that has all these old, dilapidated houses, and then on the other end of it is this huge casino. Yeah, this massive casino, and apparently that's where the casino is on Wheeling Island. I didn't know there were any casinos anywhere in West Virginia, but that's where it is. And the old dilapidated houses, maybe those are the people who one day went to the casino and didn't work out so well, so they moved down the street and moved into an old, crumbling Victorian house. That could be what happened. Who knows? But it's great walking around that place, watching boats go by, because it's right on the river. We found this radio station. We'll probably talk about this some more and off the hook. We found this radio station right there on Main Street. We saw signs for a radio station. So naturally, we barged on in and said, hey, what's this all about? Turns out in Wheeling, West Virginia, at 1600 on the AM dial, is this radio station that was recently bought by somebody who lives there, someone who actually lives in West Virginia. They own this station. It's all local. Not like the Clear Channel station down the road. No, this station is all local. It's all talk. And it's not syndicated in any way. So they actually have an old bank building, complete with a vault and everything. They have these studios. And in fact, I got to say, our studios here, I am not kidding. Our studios here at WUSB, where we have had the same equipment now for, must be over 30 years now. Same equipment. Our equipment is better. Yeah, it's true. It's true. What I saw there, they had a small mixing board, small enough that you could hold it in your hand. That was their production studio. So, and they're a commercial station. But it was amazing because they're a local station, completely local, completely for the people of Wheeling. Not a very strong signal at all, on the AM band. But they exist despite all the odds. They exist. And I just thought that was the coolest thing, to be walking down the street in this Midwestern town, or city. Pretty big city, actually. Not very many people for some reason, but a pretty big city. And to just come across this, to just come across this radio station that wasn't really that concerned with ratings, that just wanted to do good radio, that was inspiring. That's what it's all about. And wow, it's heartening to see that. Of course, we told them about this place, we told them about the other radio station, we told them about the things that we're doing, so hopefully we'll stay in contact with these folks and visit them once a year as we drive over there. That's the kind of thing you find if you look. If you just stay on the highway and don't get off the road every now and then and walk around, you're not going to see it. You'll miss out. There are all kinds of little hidden things in places you don't expect them. So, yeah, it's a great time. That's one of the traditions, going to Wheeling, West Virginia. Another tradition is the Waffle House stop on the way back. We all gather at Waffle House and basically go over what happened over the whole weekend, and then we leave. We head back west. I'm sorry, east. We head back east to New York. And it's great because you know there's a long drive ahead of you, but with every mile you go, you're getting a little bit closer. And this time I didn't make it back until well after rush hour here in New York City on Monday morning. And so usually what happens is I completely miss Monday. Monday is a lost day because I wind up sleeping throughout the entire day and feeling all jet-lagged. But like I said, I get into this mode, you know, this mode where you just kind of, you got to keep going. In fact, last year, somehow I wound up not getting any sleep the night before I went out to Dayton. Sometimes this happens to me. This is something that I get really pissed off at my body sometimes because it sabotages me. Lots of times I get along and things work out really well. For instance, I have an internal clock, which is enviable. I can wake up precisely on the minute that I need to wake up sometimes. Not all the time, but a good number of times. Problem that I do have, though, is getting to sleep before I know I have to do that. And it's especially hard when there are things around that mark the time. Like if somebody has one of those chiming clocks, that's the worst possible thing, because you know you have to get to sleep before it chimes again, or it's another 15 minutes or another half hour that you've lost, and then you're calculating the amount of time that you need to fall asleep. And those days I get, you know, maybe like an hour by the time I'm finished worrying about all of this. This year, though, I was lucky. This year, I was able to fall asleep. But last year, I wasn't. So I drove all the way out there without any sleep the night before and drove all night. So, yeah, that can be something. But if you put yourself into that zone, and I can do it with a relatively small amount of caffeine, then you really feel like you've accomplished something in the end, which is maybe just moving from one place to another, but still, that's something. And on the subject of caffeine, you know, that has a real strong effect on me. One cup of coffee, and I can go for a long, long period of time. And I guess that's a good thing. It saves money, it saves time, it saves trips to the bathroom because, you know, you're not drinking as much. But I kind of like to avoid that. I kind of like to go on my own energy as much as possible. So Dayton, yeah, you know, Dayton was interesting as always. Met a lot of cool people out there. Now this is what was unusual this year, and it happens every year where basically I wait to the last possible moment because I never know if I'm going to the last possible moment. But I don't get a room until after they're all sold out. Because keep in mind, people come from all over the world for this thing. This is a massive gathering. Yeah, it's gotten smaller. It's gotten smaller because of gas prices. It's gotten smaller because, well, a lot of people in the ham radio community have gotten older. And some have moved on to other realms. And who knows what they're doing there. But getting young people involved, that's the challenge. And things like this won't succeed if young people don't get involved. Now, it is happening, but it's not happening enough, I don't think. So this year, yeah, it was noticeably smaller. Noticeably smaller, and let's hope that's not a trend that continues. Small, though, as it may have been, all the hotel rooms were still booked. So I had to do quite a bit of creative searching. And I came upon this place that I'd never heard of before. And it just could have just sort of jumped out at me. Why did it jump out at me? It was called the Hope Hotel. Yeah, the Hope Hotel. Wow, where did this come from? Never heard of the Hope Hotel before. And it gets better. Turns out the Hope Hotel is located on a military base. Yeah, it's located right on the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Apparently, in order to do this, there had to be an act of Congress to permit a hotel that's open to the public to be located on a military base. So right there, I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, I want to go to this place. This sounds so unusual. Yeah, it's a little bit of a trek from the actual ham convention. Hambvention is what they call it. But still, we have friends there, we'll get rides, we'll figure it out somehow. Now, the place isn't actually behind the security check, because that would have been a major pain in the ass having to be checked by security every single time we went back and forth from the hotel. But it's right next to it. You go onto the base, you make an immediate right turn, and go down this road, and there you are. And this place, I'm not quite sure how it ties into the military, why military people would stay in hotels, but I would say 90% plus of the people staying there were military. And boy, you know, you have not experienced weirdness until you see that. Everybody walking around in camouflage, everybody having a uniform of some sort, everybody talking about military things. Talk about alien environments. I mean, I've been to North Korea. That was weird. This was weird, too. Not quite as weird as that. All right, but pretty damn weird. And it's kind of cool to see people in that kind of an environment and how they behave. And you realize, you know what? These people are behaving just like people behave in any environment. You know, just being relaxed, hanging out, doing the things that people do, just wearing camouflage a lot, having short hair, and that sort of thing. What was really kind of weird was that they just assumed I was military. They gave me the military discount. I'm not kidding. Which was a good discount, too, but I got the military discount. I walked in there with my black trench coat and my sunglasses on and just didn't really say a whole lot. So I think people sort of thought I was really military of some sort. Who knows what? But they were so nice. They were so friendly and hospitable. It was just so cool hanging out there, being in a place that you know you don't belong in, but somehow managing to survive. How many times have I done that? Actually, I do that every day. And then one day we were hanging out, drove onto the grounds of the hotel, the Hope Hotel, which, by the way, you know why it's called the Hope Hotel? You'll never guess. It's named after Bob Hope, because Bob Hope used to entertain the troops wherever they happened to be. So they named the hotel after him. It's got nothing to do with Hackers on Planet Earth or Hope for the Future or anything like that. It's got to do with Bob Hope. And there's this shrine to Bob Hope inside the lobby. All these pictures and certificates and things like that. So, yeah, it's named after Bob Hope. And it's really kind of weird to see signs for the Hope conferences that they have there at the Hope Hotel. Very bizarre. So we drove in one night to go back and get something before we went out carousing in suburban Dayton. And we saw two cars in front of us. Two cars in front of us that we knew right away were weird. They were DeLoreans. I'd never actually seen a DeLorean in real life before. You know, those are those cars from, what is it, the 70s or 80s? I don't know. The cars where the door opens up like a spaceship. You know, it goes from down to up, and you can ride around like that. You look like a spaceship when you're riding around with the doors hanging open like that. And there were two DeLoreans there, so we ran out to get pictures of the things. It turned out, a third one pulled up, there was some kind of DeLorean convention going on in the hotel, and before you knew it, there were 14 of them. 14 DeLoreans. That's the kind of thing that can happen when you stay in weird places. So, yeah, that was... I was going to mention Dayton for a second, actually, but as you can see, there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot that goes on. You walk around, you run into weird people and have great conversations. I want to thank everybody who stopped by, said hi to us. Had some nice back and forth at the 2600 van. Weather was interesting. It was supposed to rain all weekend. That does happen sometimes, and it's a real disaster when it does, especially because the 2600 van doesn't start in the rain. But in this particular case, it didn't rain, but it was rather windy. So apologies to anyone who was pelted with the various back issues that took off from our table like a herd of birds. Nothing we could do to prevent it, but occasionally that happened. We had to run down the parking lot to retrieve them. Looking forward to next year. And hopefully a lot of people who came to Dayton will also come to Hope in July here in New York City. Think of it this way, you know. It was an alien environment for us. New York might be an alien environment for you. Don't be afraid of New York. New York is a fascinating place. And you can figure out ways to make it cheap, places to stay for low prices, ways of getting there for almost nothing. Well, maybe not almost nothing, but not that much. And you'll meet all kinds of people. You'll see a whole different environment. And it'll be cool. It'll be as cool as it was for us to go out there. All right, more information on Hope, www.hope.net. So that's what's been going on in the last week for me. What's been going on in the last week in the world? Well, okay, you know, last show. Remember last show I talked about John Edwards, and I said that John Edwards is the perfect running mate for Barack Obama. Apparently, the word of that show got out. The very next day, John Edwards endorsed Barack Obama, but also made it clear that he was not interested in being vice president. All right, well, you know, it's not exactly how I wanted things to play out. I mean, I'm glad you guys are listening. I'm glad you guys pay attention when I say it's time for this to happen. It's time for the Barack Obama people to contact the John Edwards people and make the offer. But let's reconsider, okay? Let's reconsider how Barack Obama would win states like West Virginia and Penn. You know, it's weird because when we were driving to Dayton, I realized this whole path, from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, that's all Clinton country. Every single one of those states voted for Clinton in their primary. Isn't that weird? But the only way that you're going to win over a lot of people that are fiercely for Hillary Clinton is if you have somebody who appeals to people in those particular states. And John Edwards certainly does. Who else can we think of who will do that? Now, it's sad to say, race does play a big part in this. I was watching some of the interviews while returns were coming in. And I got to tell you, you know, there are people out there, lots of people, who just do not want a black person or a half-black person in the White House. And that's why they're not voting for Obama. It's pretty sad. You see people say things like this, that they're not comfortable. They don't want a Muslim in the White House, despite the fact that he never was a Muslim. Or someone with the middle name of Hussein. I mean, yeah, middle name. That's how you define somebody. And all kinds of other misperceptions and perceptions that are right that they just can't seem to handle. Not having a black person in the White House. That makes you uncomfortable. I'll bet not having a black person in your town probably made you uncomfortable at one point. Or maybe it still hasn't gotten to that stage in some of these towns. I don't know. But we have to get over this. Now, all that said, you know, the same problem does exist on the other side as well. It's sad that we have to talk about sides, but when you look at some of the states that have been voting heavily for Obama, and you look at black voters versus white voters, it's over 90% black voters voting for Obama. Now, we can speculate as to why that is. Maybe his positions are more of the liking of the black community, or maybe it's simply because he's not entirely white. And those are the wrong reasons. Those are the wrong reasons not to vote for somebody. Those are the wrong reasons to vote for somebody. Now, the reason I support him, the reason I think that he would be the best of the three, and maybe even the best in a very long time in our country, is because I've heard the way he enunciates, the way he speaks, the way he addresses issues, the way he's able to answer questions off the cuff without having to just simply recite something from a piece of paper. In other words, it's damn close to intelligent, you know? Something we haven't had in quite a long time, certainly not in the last 8 years. And before that, the previous 8 years with Clinton, there was a lot of just plastic, artificial nonsense where you had to kind of placate the right wing. I don't know why. But never stand up and say something for yourself. And except for the last few weeks of Clinton's presidency, when he actually seemed to grow some courage. Started pardoning people, started acting almost liberal-ish. That's what you want to see, somebody who stands up for what they believe in, whether or not you agree with it. I respect somebody like that a lot more. So with Obama, there's a hint. And the idealism, people say that he hasn't had enough experience with politics. I think that might be a good thing. Because he's not jaded. He's not corrupted. He's not like everybody else. Maybe. Now, of course, that'll change. As soon as he takes office, I'm sure he'll become more corrupt and more jaded. But, you know, for a little while, it'll seem like change is occurring. It'll seem like something is different. And that alone is a good thing. Even if it doesn't work out, just feeling that for a brief time. That's what we need. And you won't feel that with the other candidates, guaranteed. Okay, so when former Senator John Edwards endorsed Barack Obama for president last Wednesday, his motives and his endorsement's impact immediately became a topic of national debate. Speaking to a raucous crowd in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Edwards explained his decision. The Democratic voters in America have made their choice, and so have I. But Edwards' suddenly resounding support for the Obama campaign came only 9 days after he and his wife declared to People magazine that they would not endorse any candidate, and on the heels of a substantial victory by Hillary Clinton in the West Virginia primary, one of Obama's worst losses to date. So analysis pretty much says, by announcing it when they did, it was basically synchronized to hit the evening newscast, which blunted any momentum Hillary would have gotten from her bruising win in West Virginia. Now, this is encouraging because Edwards already has lied once. He said he wasn't going to endorse anybody, and he did. And now Edwards has also said, he said this on the Today Show when asked if he would be Obama's vice presidential pick, won't happen, this is not something I'm interested in. He might be lying again. He might be lying again a second time, and maybe he will be the vice presidential candidate. So keep our fingers crossed, because Edwards is somebody who can bring in the votes, and the lying is something that can come in handy when you're in power. Because you got to be good at that. And maybe Obama hasn't learned how to be good at lying yet. Well, Edwards can help. Edwards said Obama had told him, "I want you on my team. I want to help you both in the campaign and with the work we want to do when I'm the president." Now, Edwards' endorsement of Obama, who would be the first black U.S. president, came the day after Clinton won a landslide victory in West Virginia that renewed doubts about Obama's ability to draw white, low-income voters. Edwards denied his endorsement had been deliberately timed to take the wind out of her victory. "It was the right time to do it. I made the decision that the public should know at this point what my view is." He said he had voted for Obama in the recent North Carolina primary and had decided that it's time for Democrats to start uniting around this candidate. Obama has an almost insurmountable lead over Clinton in the race for delegates to the Democratic convention in August, where the party will choose its candidate for the presidency. His lead has increased pressure on Clinton to end her campaign, but she has vowed to remain in the race until the last of the state-by-state nominating contest on June 3rd. That's not that far away. Not that far away. Now, tonight is significant because what will happen tonight, in all likelihood, is that Obama is going to gain the delegate majority. Now, of course, he already has more delegates than Hillary Clinton, but by the end of tonight, he will have more than half. He's expected to take a majority of the pledged delegates in the Democratic race after primary voters weigh in both Kentucky and Oregon. Now, Obama's campaign sees the two contests as a milestone in the protracted fight for the Democratic presidential nomination with Hillary Clinton, who continues to campaign hard. Now, this is a very important threshold, they say, having the majority of pledged delegates. According to Tom Daschle, former Senate Majority Leader and Obama's campaign co-chair, he says, "We're excited about it, but it doesn't mean it's the end. To say that we have the majority of the core of the delegates that are going to be making the decisions at the convention and selecting our nominee, that's a critical milestone. Now, there are 3,253 pledged delegates, and Obama, even with a poor showing on Tuesday, should easily top the 1,627 delegates needed to gain a majority. Now, a candidate needs 2,026 delegates to win the Democratic nomination. Going into Tuesday's races, Obama has 1,909 delegates, while Clinton has 1,718. The Kentucky and Oregon primaries hold 103 delegates combined. Obama needs 15 more to achieve a majority of the pledged delegates. The delegates won either in state caucuses or primaries. Now, Clinton appears to be the overwhelming favorite in Kentucky, and Obama is a favorite in Oregon. Clinton's leading in Kentucky by 30 percentage points, where Obama is leading Oregon by 10 percentage points. So, yeah, it just keeps on going. But I think we all know where it's going to end up eventually. I'll be glad when it's done. Okay, what else has been going on? Let's see, Joseph Lieberman, he's in the news again. Remember him? The right-wing Democratic, now independent, senator from Connecticut. He's urging Google to take down YouTube videos that he said Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations use to encourage violence and disseminate propaganda. Isn't it amazing that Al-Qaeda uses YouTube? I mean, when do you think they made that decision? It's like, "Hey, Osama, look at this. This is really cool. You got to check this out. We can target all kinds of people throughout the world with these little videos." And, yeah, they're more hip than a lot of people I know as far as being able to do that. Well, anyway, it's rubbing Lieberman the wrong way. In a Monday letter to Eric Schmidt, the chief executive officer of Google, Lieberman asked that YouTube implement its own policy against this offensive material by removing the videos. Now, Lieberman, the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, also wants YouTube staffers to have a system that will prevent the video from reappearing. The letter follows the committee's staff report on terrorist internet use. And YouTube, as you may know, is a subsidiary of Google. Many of the videos produced by one of the production arms of Al-Qaeda show attacks on U.S. forces in which American soldiers are injured and in some cases killed, wrote Lieberman. The community guidelines state that graphic or gratuitous violence is not allowed. If your video shows someone getting hurt, attacked, or humiliated, don't post it. Nevertheless, those videos remain available for viewing on YouTube, he wrote. YouTube said Monday on its blog, that it had removed a number of videos from its site after examining several videos that Lieberman's staff said violated YouTube's community guidelines. The videos that were removed depicted gratuitous violence, advocated violence, or used hate speech. However, most of the videos, which did not contain violent or hate speech content, were not removed because they do not violate our community guidelines. The statement did not say how many videos were removed, and it was not immediately clear when they were taken down. Lieberman asked in his letter that YouTube immediately remove content produced by Islamist terrorist organizations, a straightforward task since so many of the Islamist terrorist organizations brand their material with logos or icons identifying their provenance. However, the video sharing website said it could not comply with the request because some of the videos that mention or feature those groups include legal, nonviolent, or non-hate speech videos. While we respect and understand his views, YouTube encourages free speech and defends everyone's rights to express unpopular points of view. We believe that YouTube is a richer and more relevant platform for users precisely because it hosts a diverse range of views. Interesting. I've always wondered, you know, how do you get access to these so-called websites where certain things are verified? Certain statements made by Al-Qaeda people are verified or presented. And I guess YouTube is pretty close to seeing firsthand what it is they're saying. Now, I don't see how that could ever be bad, as seeing firsthand what anybody is saying, whether it's some crazy lunatic psycho killer someplace or whether it's the head of a state that you don't particularly like. It's important to see what it is they're actually saying and doing. And yeah, they might be lying, they might be saying things about your regime that are not true, but I think we do a lot of that too. Not equating the two, but we certainly spread our amount of disinformation out there for the rest of the world. So it's only fair that we get our own bit of disinformation so that we can balance it. I think we're smart enough to know when something is right and when something is wrong. We don't need our leaders to filter it for us. And that's exactly what Lieberman is trying to do, yet again. Okay, more on human rights and freedom of speech and that kind of thing. Three small-town eighth graders in Minnesota were suspended by their principal for not standing last Thursday. Actually, I make that two Thursdays ago, for the Pledge of Allegiance, violating a district policy that the principal now says may soon be reworded to protect free speech rights. Kim Dahl, mother of one of the students, said, "My son wasn't being defiant against America." Her son told the Forum newspaper in Fargo that Thursday's one-day in-school what is an in-school suspension? How can you be suspended if you're inside the school? I've heard the term since I was going to school, but I never understood it. I guess you just can't do certain things. But isn't that what school is? You can't do a lot of things. Anyway, okay, one-day in-school suspension. He said it was kind of dumb because I didn't do anything wrong. It should be the people's choice. Kids in eighth grade, sounds dangerous to me. Kim Dahl, the kid's mother, said the punishment didn't fit the crime. If they wanted to know why he didn't stand, they should have made him write a paper. She said her son has been declining to stand all school year, offered no reason for sitting, and was not obligated to explain his actions. Well, then he shouldn't have to write a paper, should he? Unless it's for extra credit. The school's handbook says all students are required to stand but are not required to recite the pledge. The same is true for all four schools in the district. Mel Olson, the district's community education director, said these three students didn't stand, that is, and they got caught. He said he backs the punishment. Being a veteran and a United States of America citizen, absolutely. Olson served in the Marines in Japan during the Vietnam War and apparently didn't learn a whole lot while he was doing that. The head of the Minnesota American Civil Liberties Union said that the school's actions against the students are unconstitutional, and his office informed the district of that in a strongly worded letter. Chuck Samuelson, the Civil Liberty Group's executive director, said, "The school can't do that. That's illegal." Wow. Yes, he said, wow. I say wow, too. Can't believe this. School doesn't even know the law of the country that they're supposedly standing up for. Samuelson said that numerous U.S. Supreme Court rulings dating back to the 1940s, remember those? The 1940s, before the Red Scare, say in well-settled constitutional law that students who refuse to participate in the pledge cannot be punished for refusing to participate. Samuelson said he's surprised that any public school district would have such a pledge requirement, given that state law allows for students and teachers to decide not to participate. Most states have the same opt-out provision. In St. Paul, district spokesman Howie Padilla said students can respectfully not participate in the Pledge of Allegiance. Minneapolis schools treat pledge participation the same way. Colleen Hoglum, the principal who suspended the three, acknowledged in a statement that the policy requirement that all students will stand may need to be modified to address the protection of the individual's form of expression. In other words, whoops, we messed up, and our rules don't fit in with what's legal. Now, Kim Dahl, one of the troublemaker's mothers, said Hoglum called her recently, informed her of the possible accommodation. "I think they're handling it quite professionally," she said, adding that the principal told her the school officials are taking some steps to take the suspensions off their records. That possible shift was met with disappointment from Olson. You know, he's the Marine. He said he'll fall in line with whatever change may occur. "I still have my beliefs." Anyway, the principal said all students were involved in some fashion during the pledge, adding that no additional suspensions were needed. However, the family of 14-year-old Bishop Edens said that he was suspended from school on Friday, the day after, because he wouldn't stand for the pledge, but was quickly invited back once the principal said a policy change might be needed. Edens had said Thursday that he would sit in support of the other three. This is a fourth student now doing this. Now, I think this is something everybody should do. Not necessarily for your beliefs, but just to stand up for freedom of speech. Stand up by sitting down. And I say we should have a day. Maybe we can figure it out on our own when that day will be. A day when everybody sits down when the pledge is said. And in a way, that is showing more respect for the Pledge of Allegiance than just blindly following and doing what you're told. It's saying, I'm an individual. I live in a country where individuality is respected, and I'm going to express my individuality in this particular way. While the pledge is being said, I'm going to sit down. Imagine if everybody did that. That's not showing disrespect to your country. That's showing that you have a brain, that you have a way of actually thinking things through and not just following orders. What better way to honor what the Pledge of Allegiance is supposedly all about than to do that? So, folks, let's pick a day. Let's pick a day to do this. Obviously, it has to be before school ends. It's going to happen pretty soon. So, what do you say, next Monday? Next Monday? What's the date of next Monday? That's Memorial Day. I think they might be off for Memorial Day. So, let's make it next Tuesday, the 27th. Then we can talk about it on the radio. I'll bet nobody's going to do it. I'll bet none of you have the guts. Spread the word. Don't make me do everything. I've got enough to worry about. I want to see people go out there and start announcing all around the world, or around the country anyway. They don't say the Pledge of Allegiance in other parts of the world, do they? Just announce it. Spread it around. Make it viral. Say, Tuesday, May 27th, 2008, sit down when the Pledge of Allegiance is said and show your support for America. That's right. I'm not kidding. I am not kidding. This is something that I think should be done. All right, write to me, otw@2600.com. Let me know if that's actually happening someplace, and we'll certainly talk about it next week if it does. Nothing would make me happier. Nothing would make me happier than seeing that happen. All right. Let's read a couple bits of mail. Wow, the time goes by fast. I can really banter on, can't I? Okay, dear Manuel, I just finished listening to today's show. I wanted to comment that you were very correct in assuming that not all West Virginians, or in my case, Kentuckians, vote based solely on a person's race, although there are a few rare cases where outdated ideals of racism / sexism influence people's voting decisions. For the most part, people have realized that it is, in fact, the 21st century, and racism is a thing of the past. Well, that would be nice. And that there's a desperate need for change in the Oval Office, regardless of the race or gender of the next president. Also, in response to the question in a previous show on why election days are held on a Tuesday, I found this informative passage that shows that the tradition of a Tuesday election dates all the way back to 1845. Now, by federal law, since 1792, Congress permitted the states to conduct their presidential elections or otherwise to choose their electors any time in a 34-day period before the first Wednesday of December, which was the day set for the meeting of the electors of the U.S. President and Vice President, that is, the Electoral College, in their respective states. An election date in November was seen as useful because the harvest would have been completed, which is an important thing in an agrarian society, and the winter storms would not yet have begun in earnest. And that was a plus in the days before paved roads and snowplows. However, the problems born of this arrangement were obvious and were intensified by improved communications via train and telegraph. The states that voted later could swell, diminish, or be influenced by a candidate's victories in the states that voted earlier. In close elections, the states that voted last might well determine the outcome. A uniform date for choosing presidential electors was instituted by the U.S. Congress in 1845. You know, I like how I'm saying the date? I kind of like saying it that way. We say 2001, we say 2008. Why not put an N there everywhere? People used to do that. It used to be so much better. Anyway, many theories have been advanced as to why the Congress settled on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. And that's what it is. It's not the first Tuesday in November. It's the first Tuesday after the first Monday. How bizarre is that? The actual reasons, as shown in records of congressional debate on the bill in December 1844, were fairly prosaic. The bill initially set the national day for choosing presidential electors on the first Tuesday in November in years divisible by four, 1848, 1852, etc. But it was pointed out that in some years, the period between the first Tuesday in November and the first Wednesday in December, when the Electoral College met, it would be more than 34 days, in violation of the existing Electoral College law. So the bill was amended to move the national date for choosing presidential electors forward to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, which was a date scheme already used in the state of New York, because we're ahead of everybody else and we're just so modern in the way we do things. Oh, wow. I can't believe they can do all that, but they can't fix it so that it makes sense today and maybe make it like a weekend election like almost every other country does. As for the day of the week chosen, Sunday was ruled out because it was the Sabbath. Can't have an election on the Sabbath. An election on Monday might require travel on Sunday, and so it was also ruled out. Tuesday, though, there was no problem. Thanks, Seth, for all your hard work and consistently putting out such an informative and entertaining show on the radio on a weekly basis. It's greatly appreciated. Signed, Nathan from Kentucky. Nathan from Kentucky, thank you. Your letter is appreciated. And we certainly hope to hear from more people in your neck of the woods, especially since you're in the news tonight. Kentucky definitely is going to be talked about in tomorrow's papers and all that. Here's one more letter concerning Dayton. Manuel, be sure to check out the Wright Brothers National Park Service exhibits in Dayton and take a ride on a Czech-built electric trolley bus. Signed, Eric. Well, Eric, I didn't do that. I'm sorry. But I did stay on the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and that the Wright in that name was named after at least one of the Wright brothers. I don't know who the hell Patterson is, but I guess that's neither here nor there. Hey, you know what? We're out of time. And I guess that means that we won't take calls tonight. We'll take calls next week, hopefully. You can write to us, otw@2600.com. I want to see on national news the sit-down for the Pledge of Allegiance movement, which we just started only a few minutes ago. Write to us, otw@2600.com. And listen to Off the Hook tomorrow night, where it's yet another fundraiser. Hopefully we'll keep that place going as well. Stay tuned, keep listening, and try to stay happy. Good night.
Nobody loves you when you're down and out. Nobody sees you when you're on cloud nine. Everybody's hustling for a buck and a dime. I'll scratch your back and you scratch mine. I've been across to the other side. I've shown you everything. I got nothing to hide. But still you ask me, do I love you? What it is, what it is. All I can tell you is, it's all showbiz. All I can tell you is, it's all showbiz. What it is, what it is, what it is, what it is. Nobody loves you when you're down and out. Nobody knows you when you're on cloud nine. Everybody's hustling for a buck and a dime. I'll scratch your back and you knife mine. I've been across the water now so many times. I've seen the one-eyed witch doctor leading the blind. But still you ask me, do I love you? What you say, what you say. Every time I put my finger on it, slips away. Every time I put my finger on it, it slips away.
Stay happy right here on this Tuesday evening, right here on WUSB Stony Brook.